Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Let's also pay a little attention to this. I'm reading from the Chicago Tribune the other day. Chicago Reader employees to rally to save alternative newspaper. The Chicago Reader is the city's alternative newspaper and has been for more than 50 years. The Tribune said it's running out of time and it's running out of money. And there has been a sort of brewing controversy over there. On top of how do we keep this publication going and doing the kind of journalism it does, is the complication that two of the people who bought it, who saved it, if you will, are making it difficult for the thing to exist. Eric Zorn is the author of the Picayune Sentinel, the publisher of a weekly newsletter. He's a longtime Chicago Tribune columnist. Now Eric's doing this. Hey, Eric, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, John. Doing really well.
So,
how are you doing?
Good. So let's just talk a little bit about this Chicago Reader story. Why... I mean, I'm familiar with it, but I guess we should start with the two people that bought it and the editorial or the opinion piece that one of them wrote, right?
Well, I mean, I think you might want to rewind 50 years and talk about the role that the Reader has played in Chicago journalism and why this is an important story to talk about. But the Reader has been, like I say, around for a long time. It used to be a really fat publication that had all the ads for apartments, and it was the first thing that a lot of people read when they got to town and did a lot of groundbreaking investigations about police torture and so on. So it's been a vital part of this community. It's not a sideline. It's an important institution. It was going broke a few years ago in 2018. Two people ended up buying it for a dollar from the Sun-Times, and that was Len Goodman and Chicago real estate developer L.G. Higginbottom. Goodman is a very wealthy defense attorney. He's also part of the Crown family, so he's got money to throw around. And these two invested about $1 million each into the publication, plus some other things they put into it, and they saved it, and they were heroes. And the Reader went on, but there was a realization that it had to transition to a not-for-profit. So let's get to this column. So Len Goodman is in his spare time does commentary, does writing about, you know, various political issues. And he wrote a column for the Reader. He wrote, I think, about once a month. He submitted a column and they ran it. And it's probably not because he was the best person in the city to write a column, but he was a co-owner. And so this creates a situation that's ripe for problems when you have the boss submitting a column to lowly editors and telling them to approve it. So in November, he submitted a column talking about why he was reluctant to get his six-year-old daughter vaccinated for COVID-19. And it was he was skeptical about the scientific claims to the vaccine for children, and he cited a bunch of people who are somewhat controversial in their opinions. And the Reader signed off on it. The editor in charge of his column said, you know, good job, and posted it to this Reader website, and it's created a real firestorm that the Reader readership and the Reader staff was in an uproar about it. They thought that it was inaccurate, and they thought it was irresponsible for the Reader to publish it. So what happened was publisher Tracy Bain, who is a very respected voice in the city, she wanted to either pull the column down from the web, or she wanted to run an edited version of it that was sort of run through a fact checker.
But wait a minute, this is all after it ran, right?
This is all after it ran. And I can understand, and Goodman is very mad about this, that if they decided to take his column after it ran, and they wanted either to take it down from the site or they wanted to rewrite it. And a third option was presented, which a lot of the stories on this have missed, which is that Bain, the publisher, offered Len Goodman, the co-owner, the opportunity to write a rebuttal to a fact check article. So they were going to run a fact check piece, and then they were going to run a rebuttal to it. Which is reasonable. That last option is a reasonable thing for, I mean, anytime, and this happened to me when I was writing columns for the Tribune, where I would write a column that would make people mad, and then someone would write an op-ed or a letter to the editor calling me a numbskull, and that was the way the game's played. It's like, you know, when you put your opinion out there, your opinion is subject to criticism, and that's reasonable. I think it was a bad idea for them to think about taking the column down. But in any case, nothing happened. The column is up the way it always was, and there's no rebuttal, there's no fact check, there's no nothing. It's there. But Goodman, the owner, the investor, is still really mad about it, and he is holding up right now, single-handedly, basically, or with some help from his allies on the board of directors, he's holding up the Reader's transition to a not-for-profit publication, which is widely considered to be integral to the future of the publication, and it's one that has been in the works for a long time, that they have been slowly trying to create this not-for-profit organization. And Goodman had, in fact, signed off on this. Basically, early on, he had helped them raise money for it. But this issue of the column that came up has thrown a huge wrench into the works. Last Thursday, the Reader Union and staffers were rallying outside of Goodman's home in East Lakeview, and telling him, "Let my paper go," was one of the signs they had. But they're asking Goodman just to go away, to say, "Hey, look, I'm done." And there are about 400 signatures right now, including mine, on a open letter to Goodman telling him to stop being such a baby about it.
Okay, let me ask you this. I want you to explain to us a little more about what the column was that he wrote that was so troubling to the staff and maybe anybody else that read it. But before you even do that, the column runs. Then they said, maybe we should take it down. Which is silly to me, because in a digital world, you never take anything down. But I think it should live on your site. If it lived once, it should stay. But then the rebuttal to it would have been written by somebody that who would have written the rebuttal to it then?
Well, they had commissioned a fact checker to do it. And this is someone who, I don't know who it is. It's an anonymous fact checker, but it's someone who had sort of gone through his column. So point by point, this study that you're citing is not peer reviewed. This expert you're citing is not actually an expert, and so on, point by point. I think there were 15 points of disagreement.
And that fact check rebuttal never ran, though, right?
It never ran, and at the end of the day, Tracy Bain, the publisher, offered an opportunity to Goodman to write a rebuttal to the fact check.
It would have
been
okay.
The column, fact check, rebuttal. Which is a little unconventional, but not out of line. I mean, this is honestly the issue of COVID vaccines and children and just COVID vaccines in general. Way better than I do, John, that this is an issue that has people riled up. It has people talking. There are reasonable people who disagree on this. I think the vast weight of scientific opinion is on the side of vaccines, but it's important to hear these arguments and deal with them rather than just erase them. So in that sense, I think Goodman was right in being upset about this. I would have been upset about it if the Tribune had ever yanked a column of mine down once they posted it.
Yeah, but it makes you wonder why they ran it in the first place. If they had these reservations, and I know it's awkward when it's the boss, when it's the owner, when it's the guy that saved your butt, but was there much give and take? Did they say, gee, at least this is going to be incendiary, and maybe it's not even right. Did he get that message from the editorial staff?
No, he didn't, and that's part of the problem here. And I got access to the entire email thread between Goodman and Maim, and also some with his direct line editor. That was all preserved. I got access to all their emails, and it turns out that the editor who was in charge of his column just sort of said, good job. She said, it's bulletproof. Thanks for doing this. So the editor who was in charge didn't flag it as a problem. It didn't go through huge meetings and hand-wringing at the time, which it probably should have. And the question that you have to ask, which is, would it have if it weren't for the fact that the boss had submitted?
Well, what does your industry do, the print journalism and newspaper business do, when somebody turns in an op-ed piece and not only do you disagree with it, but you think, like you said, some of these studies aren't peer-reviewed. We don't think this really stands up to a lot of scientific scrutiny, but hey, it's an opinion piece, and a lot of people don't want their kids to get vaccinated. So would a Tribune or should the Reader publish that just because it sort of validates what a lot of people are thinking or feeling, or because you all have decided that we don't like your opinion, we're not going to run it? What's a newspaper to do in a situation like that?
In my view, I think the newspaper needs to fact check it first And there's a difference, obviously, between fact and opinion. And a responsible news organization, the Tribune, I sat right next to the woman who handled the Tribune op-ed essays for 3 or 4 years, and she went through every column, every story carefully, not to get out opinions, but to make sure that the facts are right. If you're going to cite a study, does that study say what you say it says? If you're going to call somebody an expert, is that person legitimate?
Would you have run this story then? Do you think the Tribune or you would have run this story, this opinion piece?
I think that they might have run it with some edits. I think they might. When I've written about this, I've been careful not to really get involved in the scientific debate over it, which is sort of a separate issue. And in that sense, I'm on the side myself of giving breath to these kind of opinions and letting people express their views. And I think the Tribune is also, and I think the Reader is too. It's just that in this case, the judgment, the after the fact judgment of the editors was that they screwed up. And it's not censorship. And Goodman and his allies on the board have been crying about censorship. This is not censorship. Censorship is when the government steps in. This is editing. And it may have been clumsy editing, and it may have been something that you would regret in hindsight. It should have been done another way. I think everybody probably agrees that it should have been done a different way.
Right.
But the question at the end of the day is, who has that responsibility? And in this case, it is the editor. And every decision, when I wrote a column for 35 years or so at the Tribune, every editing decision was debatable, and I got into some arguments occasionally. But at the end of the day, it was the editor's decision. And I didn't claim censorship. I disagree.
Oh, yeah, but hold on, because there's the editor and then there's the publisher, and the editor reports to the publisher, right? Do me this favor, Eric. I got to pause. Let's just come back and wrap this up with this. Can you? I know you don't want to get into the scientific debate about it all, but can you point to a couple of specifics that gave the editorial staff pause? I mean, what was it that this person said? Even though it might be other people's shared opinion, what was it that this person said was upsetting to everybody? Give me an example or two. Eric Zorn's the publisher of something called the Picayune Sentinel. He's also, I believe, the entire staff of the Picayune Sentinel. Or have you hired out help now, Eric?
I have actually hired a copy editor to help me with my typos. But
nice.
Otherwise, I do everything so that when I publish a controversial piece, no one can complain.
Wouldn't it be funny if you turned it into your editor and that person said, no, I don't think it's factually true enough and I'm not going to publish it? I'm not going to forward it back to you?
Yes, that would be very funny, John.
Eric is in the Picayune Sentinel, the weekly newsletter that he drops on Wednesday afternoons. Pardon me, Eric, it drops on Thursdays, right?
It drops on Thursdays so that I can have highlights in there from our Meeting Rascals podcast, which records on Wednesday afternoon.
You do that, and we appreciate that. So the podcast drops on Wednesdays, and Eric's piece moves on Thursdays. You can get it for free. You can also pay a premium prescription to keep this kind of writing in Chicago going, and you're writing about what's happened to the Reader over the years. And this all stems of late over an opinion piece that was written by, I said it was Higginbottom, but it was actually Goodman that wrote the piece, Len Goodman, where he expressed concerns about vaccinating his 6-year-old daughter against COVID-19. And that's where the backlash all came from. What were some of the things that he was saying?
Well, one of the things was he cited Dr. Robert Malone, who is an anti-vax person out there, and as an expert, and there's a lot of controversy about whether Malone is deserving to be an expert. The fact checker cited him or threw a flag for him citing statements from Mexico's health minister, Jorge Varela, I think you say it, because Goodman said that he recommended against vaccinating children and warned that they could inhibit development of the children's immune system. The fact checker said that there's no evidence that this is the case with COVID vaccines or any other vaccines. But Goodman says, well, that's Varela's opinion. And so it's the kind of thing they're going back and forth about. There's questions about the studies that he cites, the sources that he cites, and whether he is adequately taking into account the views of those who believe that children should be vaccinated.
Yeah.
All this stuff is, it's one of these debates that people are having. As I said, I'm on the side of vaccinating people. I think that the vaccines have proven astoundingly successful and that we would be in a better place if everyone had been vaccinated. But I think that the idea of suppressing all points of view on this is not a good one. And so, as again, I mean, getting back to this whole controversy as to, you know, should the reader have published this essay as it was? Should they have? And I think the clear answer is they should have edited it more carefully and thought about it more carefully before they published it. I think everybody would agree with that. And I think most people would agree with you, John, and with me, that taking it down after the fact, once it's up, it's up. You can add contextual information. And that's where Goodman got really mad. The writer of the piece, Glenn Goodman, got mad. He didn't want this fact check published. He didn't want this rebuttal published. He wanted to let it stand where it is. And in fact, that's what happened. That's where it is right now. And so right now, I think the lawyers are meeting today to try to see if they can hammer out some sort of settlement, because Goodman wants representatives on the not-for-profit board. Higginbottom wants representatives on the not-for-profit board. These two rich guys are still trying to control the paper, even when it goes to not-for-profit status. They want Tracy Bain gone, or Goodman wants Tracy Bain gone, the publisher. And I've heard from sources, and I talked to the head of the union last night, who said that they had their last paychecks on Friday, and they're not sure they're going to get another paycheck out next Friday. And these are not wealthy people; these people who are writing and shooting photos for the Reader or an editing copy. They are not at the top of the pay scale. So they have people who got rent payments to make, car payments to make, utility bills to pay, and so on. So we're really at a crisis point right now with this publication, and I think it's time for these wealthy people for us to say thank you very much for saving the Reader in 2018, and now you can get on your high horses and ride off into the sunset and let the Reader go, let the Reader flourish the way it has flourished for the last 50 years.
So awkward when the boss or the owner wants to write or say something. And what are you going to do, you know?
Well, that's the nub of this problem. That's the root of the problem, is that you should never be in a position where someone with that kind of power has control of a column, because it this kind of problem was almost inevitable. And they got away with it for 20 columns, and suddenly you write something, and I don't think the editors knew how to respond.
Yeah.
I think the whole question is not what happened back then. It was clearly a mess up on many levels. How do we go forward? I think the way we go forward is for these investors to back away, let the not-for-profit board do its thing, and wish good luck to the Chicago Reader.
That's Eric Zorn, Picayune Sentinel. You can Google that. Email ericzorn@gmail.com if you want to automatically be put on the list, and listen for our Mincing Rascals podcast. I'll talk to you on Wednesday, Eric.
Thanks, John.
Nice to talk to you, sir. Interesting story. We'll see how that plays out today, huh?